Hey, 2019 is upon us, and that means you need to go to leadingsaints.org and get the 2019 Ward Calendar. This is a huge wall calendar that shows every day of the year and does a fantastic job in the bishop's office, in the ward clerk's office, or even on the ward bulletin board. Go check it out at leadingsaints.org and order one today.
My name is Paul Kruger from Cape Town, South Africa. As a convert to the church, the information available on Leading LDS has fast-forwarded my knowledge of serving in the church. I love listening to the podcast on Leading LDS, which is so spiritually uplifting. I know about the loneliness of leadership and how I need this information to guide me through my days. It's amazing how blessed we are as members of the church to not only have to work during the week, to make a living, and then again on weekends, just to get better ourselves. One of my favorite podcasts is the one with Elder Groberg, so much so that I watched this movie, The Other Side of Heaven, a few times now. People like him just keep on giving and giving of himself without expecting any rewards. This has motivated me to raise my own bar. I'm super excited with Kurt's book, A Culture of Ministering, which we will shortly use as part of training our relief societies and elders' quorums. Leading LDS truly helped me to be a leader, not a calling.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Leading Saints Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham, and I will be your host. Now, if you're new to the Leading Saints Podcast, this is an organization that we have going that helps lay leaders in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints be better prepared to lead. And one of the ways we do that is through podcast. And that's what this is. I'm so glad you've joined us. And you should be sure to visit leadingsaints.org for even more information. Now, as many of you remember, I have recently had the opportunity to go down to Phoenix, Arizona, and visit a variety of people there and do some interviews. And I also took time to stop off at Gilbert, Arizona, which is in the area, and talk with Blair and Cindy Packard. Now, Blair and Cindy are phenomenal individuals, and it's such a blessing to be connected with them. Shout out to Mark Matheson for doing that. But we sat down and talked about a charity and nonprofit they've started called Care for Life. You can see all the information on that at careforlife.org. But this is a nonprofit charity that they've started to assist the country of Mozambique. And it's not your typical African charity that you may hear of you know, digging wells or providing water or food or jobs or those things, but they really focus on establishing cycles of self-reliance. And this was such a fun conversation because there were so many parallels that we can make from the work they're doing on a much grander scale, so on a micro scale, and how leaders in the church, especially bishops and relief societies, relief society presidents who are working with individuals on a more micro scale in day-to-day life with helping them being self-reliant through our welfare resources and program. And it turned out to be a fantastic interview. And also, some of you may have remembered a story that they were involved in that you may not realize. Back in 2009, I believe it was, when President Nelson and his wife were in Mozambique, on church business, they were actually held captive for a short time with Blair and Cindy Packard. And so, of course, I took the time at the beginning to have them tell that story. And you'll probably hear more of it as future biographies and books are written on President Nelson, but fascinating story nonetheless. But the overall overarching theme of this great episode is really the principles of self-reliance, and the things that they're doing through Care for Life in Mozambique is just so inspiring. I encourage you to listen here, and after the interview, check out more information about Care for Life. So here's my interview with Blair and Cindy Packard. Today, I find myself in Mesa, Arizona, with Blair and Cindy Packard. How are you two?
We're great.
Good.
Awesome.
Good. Good to be with you.
Yeah.
It's Gilbert.
Is it Gilbert? We're in Gilbert, Arizona.
We have a temple now.
Oh, that's right. So strike that from the record. We're in Gilbert, Arizona. But how long have you guys been here?
Since 81. We were in Mesa before. We moved to Gilbert in 1981.
Oh, wow. Okay. And built this home?
We did.
Nice. Nice. And
originally
raised a family and
from Utah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Raised our kids, and they're all gone, but one that's kind of back and forth as a freshman at BYU.
Awesome. Very nice. And we got all sorts of good content to talk about, but maybe just give us a general background on who you are and put yourself in context for the listening audience.
Well, I'm a physical therapist by profession. We finished up our training in 1976, moved to Arizona, lived in Mesa for a few years and out here. 7 kids. I have a busy physical therapy practice. What else would you like to know about us?
That's good.
We have 25 grandchildren.
Nice.
I'm a midwife.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Wow. We had a midwife for all of our pregnancies.
Oh, awesome.
So it was awesome.
That was kind of our link to Africa.
So. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And now you were a, this is, we're going to talk a lot about Africa, primarily Mozambique, and some charity work that you've done there, a nonprofit you've started called Care for Life. And, but you've also had opportunity to serve as mission president and wife there. How long ago was that?
That was from 2006 to 2009.
Oh, wow.
Okay. 3 years.
And we served a short-term humanitarian mission there in 2005 with the measles campaign. So,
nice.
But we started, our first trip there was in 2000. And
nice.
That's when we started our nonprofit.
So was it a surprise to hear that you were called there to be the mission president? Or I'm sure they
yes.
knew your background and knew that you were familiar with that country.
I'm always surprised by callings.
Right.
The spirit doesn't sneak up on me and say, you're going to get this calling.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were very surprised when it came. And the short-term mission assignment was something that I think was more down our alley because we've been working with Care for Life. We've been doing humanitarian work. And so the church and Gary Flake knew what we were doing. And so I think he arranged for that assignment. But the mission president was, you know, took us completely by surprise.
Wow. And anything memorable about that call coming that you remember? Usually it's a phone call, right?
One of the reasons it took us by surprise is from the very beginning, you know, we would keep the area presidency informed about what we were doing. But the biggest advice we got was, you know, don't blur the lines between Care for Life and the church.
You know? Yeah, sure.
We don't want people to think Care for Life is the church and vice versa. And so when then we were called, that was an interesting experience. And
the other surprise was our language capacity.
Uh-huh.
when Elder Oaks, now President Oaks, interviewed us, he said, I've got you guys down here as a 3 on a 1 to 5 scale with Portuguese. And I said, wait a minute. Cindy might be up there maybe at a 2 because she's been going to Mozambique several times and picked up some of the language I had not picked up.
And Portuguese is the language? Yeah?
Portuguese is the language.
Oh, really? Wow.
So I had simple greetings. That's less than a 1. And so we told Elder Oaks that and he said, well, I'm just going to average it, you know, as a 3. I'm going to leave it as a 3.
Oh,
I wanted to ask him where he got his math training at. So that came as a surprise. I'd had no language training, not even a single language class in my entire life. And we were called to preside over a Portuguese-speaking mission.
Interesting. And did you serve as a young man somewhere?
No.
Oh, okay.
So just English.
Wow.
And we had previously adopted a little girl from Mozambique. So at the time that we went back as mission president, she was 6. We adopted her when she was 3. And President Hinckley, when he first looked at the call, he's like, wait, why are we sending a family with a 3-year-old? I mean, with a 6-year-old? To Mozambique. And then they did some background and said, oh, she's actually from Mozambique. And so it was a lovely thing for her to go back and be able to get to know her culture.
Yeah.
And
the one thing about going there is we'd already been there. So there was no culture shock for us to go. I mean, we knew the people, we knew most of the church leaders, even some of the government officials. And so there was no waiting period to get us used to the culture of Mozambique.
Wow, what a blessing.
Except we had to take off the Care for Life hat and put on the church hat. And we couldn't do both at the same time. And so...
Yeah, take a break from that.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, many people may remember this a few years back in the news, and I just remember just as a headline and some vague details coming, but it was Elder Nelson at the time that came and visited you with his wife, Wendy, and there was like a hostage situation. Would you mind just, I can't go on with the interview without hearing maybe some details of this story.
We'll
and
just
what
give
transpired.
You a very brief introduction.
Sure.
Yeah, we had a month to go in our mission assignment, and Elder Nelson was going to make a mission tour visit to our mission with all of our missionaries. And have a district conference with a church as well. So we'd been with him for a couple of days in Kruger Park. We'd been invited by Elder Nelson and by Parmalee, who were the area president, to join them. So we did that for a couple of days, came to Mozambique, and we had the first night they were there, we just had a dinner. And at the end of our dinner, We had three armed men come through our side door.
They just walked in.
Well,
they overpowered our guard.
We had a guard.
Oh, okay. You had a guard
that was in the front.
Unarmed guard, but they overpowered him. They came in and they all had guns. And so we had, 10, 15 minutes of an interesting situation where
they probably felt like an eternity, even though
they wanted money. They wanted, they wanted to threaten us. But they were just after money. It was a robbery.
Yeah. And was there, other than maybe just prayer, was there anything in particular that diffused the situation?
Cindy.
Well, when I look back on it now, and it was a very spiritual experience because I really had just very strong impressions. And when they first walked in, I heard, get help, get help. And so I tried to get out. The first time I tried to get out, they caught me and the guy kind of beat me up and I ended up with a broken arm. But I was able to get away later after I was outside. But through the whole thing, I really heard this voice in my head just telling me what to do. Through each stage of it. And so it really was a spiritual thing. And I finally did get out and I started yelling for help. And then they realized that I had gotten out. And so they left and that's what ended up. But it really was the Lord just guided us and protected us, protected Elder Nelson,
We all felt amazingly calm during this whole circumstance.
Right. I know Wendy had similar experience. And so, it was the Lord allowed it to happen for a reason. And down the road, we feel like it was very kind of a turning point for the church there in a lot of ways. Yeah. And so looking back on it, it was a spiritual experience.
Yeah. Wow.
That the Lord allowed to happen. So.
And now you have quite a connection to the Nilsons. I mean, when you experience something like that, it's...
we've bonded over that and
oh my goodness.
love them so much.
So that was 15 minutes out of 3 years that was just remarkable, right?
And then we did have to go home. I had to go home for surgery my husband... Then they said he's going with me. So he ran the mission for a month
after
he got home.
By telephone.
Oh, just remotely.
From here to Mozambique.
Oh, my goodness.
With his assistant in the office couple. But yeah.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad everything worked out. But quite a story for sure. Yeah. So then, but before you going to Mozambique as mission president, you started a nonprofit called Care for Life. And maybe tell us the inception of this, of this nonprofit.
Well, I had a friend who had gone to Africa and knew that I was a midwife. And she said, there's so many problems over here. You've got to do something. You've got to come and help. And at the time I was serving as Stake Relief Society president, our lives were super busy. And I thought, yeah, someday I'll do that. Someday down the road, we'll go on a humanitarian mission or something. And she's like, just pray about it. And I prayed about it and got a really strong answer that, yeah, this was something I was supposed to do. And so I was supportive of it. So I went over on a look-see, kind of.
7 weeks.
I got a really strong answer one time when I was reading in the church news, and it said 50% of the babies are dying over there because no one's interested in training midwives anymore. So that's when something hit my heart. So I went, make a long story short, we had a lot of experiences over there that really confirmed that there was a huge need, and we kind of thought, well, maybe we can just help somebody that's already doing it, but we couldn't find anyone really doing that. And so we decided to start our own nonprofit.
So Cindy came home, told me all these stories about their 7 weeks in Africa, says, you need to come back. You need to experience this yourself. And so 6 or 7 months later, she dragged me back to Mozambique. And we spent 3 weeks there and it was remarkable. We arrived just 2 weeks after a major hurricane had struck the Mozambique coast. And we'd had a prearranged appointment with a minister of health, which fell through because he was up dealing with this crisis. So we went up to where the hurricane had hit. And the first night there, we spent time, with the three local branch presidents. We were introduced by the missionaries, these branch presidents, and they just told us about their experiences. And we went out the next day with two of them and just visited some of their members and just saw the humble, very dire circumstances that we're in. So we went back to the one, decent hotel in the city that night. And I remember that during that night, we both found ourselves awake, lying on our backs, tears streaming down our faces from what we experienced that day. And we just woke up and started talking about how we needed to come back. We couldn't walk away from that experience without doing something. So that when we came home, that really was our motivation to come home and then start researching about what it took to form a nonprofit. We didn't know about nonprofits.
I've been there. Yeah.
I know about Mozambique.
And as we looked at the way nonprofits worked, everyone gave us the advice, just do one thing and do it well, be McDonald's, just do one thing. But the needs were so great. We couldn't just go in and just do one thing, literacy or, you know, water, because they needed it all. And there was no one else doing those things. And I remember on my first trip, everywhere we went, people would say, oh, we need this, we need this, we need all these things, you know, we need food, we need buildings. And I finally said to this one man that was sitting there, an older man, I said, you know, I'm just one woman. Can you boil it down? What is the one thing you need the most of all the things that you need? And he thought for a minute and he said, we need knowledge. And that was kind of our starting point. And we came home, we read a lot of books. And one of the books that I read was called People First. And it said, go to the people, live with them, love them, learn from them, work with them. Start with what they have, build on what they know. And in the end, the people will rejoice and say, we have done it ourselves. So that kind of became our motto.
Yeah.
And we came home, we created Care for Life, with the mission of Care for Life is to alleviate suffering, promote self-reliance, and instill hope.
Awesome.
And
wow.
That's been our mission.
Yeah. And now at this point, maybe people are listening and thinking, well, why are we on this leadership podcast talking about a, you know, a charity that helps people in Africa? And as we go through this, the reason I wanted to, and I was encouraged to interview you, was I feel like there are some strong welfare self-reliance principles that come out of this because of your, I don't know if I'd call it untraditional approach to maybe a serving such an impoverished community and culture as we see in Africa. Because I think you recommended, what's that? I can't think of the name, the documentary on Netflix you told me to check out about.
Oh, this. Poverty Inc.
Poverty Inc. Holy cow. What a powerful, powerful documentary. Mm-hmm. I encourage anybody to go check it out, especially from a non, you know, someone that runs a nonprofit, obviously not in these types of cultures, but at least not directly. But it really helps me step back and think, wow, you can do a lot of unintentional harm to a community by being trying to help. Right.
And I think that's what had happened in Africa, was that well-meaning people wanted to help and they'd hear these sad stories. And so we send blankets and we send food and we send shoes and then we put the clothing people out of business there that are trying to work. And, you know, there's a whole complicated thing there. So we're actually creating dependence very often when we think that we're helping. And one of the things that we learned, and of course, we went through that too, when we got there initially, people come to your door and they're starving. And so, yeah, let's give them some food. And, you know, we had to go through this thing. And one of the things that really alerted us to change direction was the sheer numbers of orphans in Africa. So everybody goes, let's go work at an orphanage. Let's help this orphanage. When we started, I think it was like there was 25 million orphans in sub-Saharan Africa. And that number was just growing to 50 million. You know, I mean, it was projecting just to go forward. And we're like, where's this drop in the ocean if we just go to one orphanage and help? We thought we've got to get in front of this flood of orphans. So we looked at the fact that, and here's where we often make a mistake with like helping in orphanages, is most of those kids have families, but those families are so poor, they send their kids to the orphanage because at least they can get food and go to school. Maybe they only have one parent or they have a grandparent, but they do have a family. So what we decided to do was go into the orphan prevention business and go back to the family of origin and help that family prevent their family falling apart, prevent mothers dying and prevent babies dying. And I think with welfare in the same principles, often we're treating the secondary problem, not going back to the primary problem and really fixing that. It's easier just to, okay, give them a food order, you know, or pay their rent for the month. But really in 6 months or a year, it's going to be the same problem. And so we had to kind of take that big step back and go, no, we're going to do this differently. So we went back to the village level and we found out what the problems were. And they didn't know what was making them sick. They didn't know how to set a goal. They didn't know how to work together. And so we go into a village. We are there for 2.5 years, but we tell them right at the very beginning, we are not here permanently and we're not here to do the work for you. You're going to do it yourself. And we're going to teach you the knowledge and skills that you need to become self-reliant.
Yeah. And you mentioned this dichotomy between primary problems and secondary problems, because it's so easy, especially going to a culture like that and think everybody's thirsty. Let's give them, let's dig a well. Or you need, you know, the kids aren't going to school. Let's build a school. Yeah. Right. And and then you sort of leave there feeling like, all right, we did our part and maybe we'll come back next year and do it again.
Right. And we did that initially. Like we started it. We opened a little center and we had classes and people came to our classes. So we taught an agriculture class, how to grow a garden. Oh, everybody came to the class. They loved it. We gave them seeds. They graduated. They went home. We went visit their garden you know, 6 months later, and it's just overrun with weeds, and they didn't know how to take care of it. They didn't know how to long-term manage it and all of that. So the way we changed is that we decided to go into the villages and mentor them. So it can't just be what we call parachute project. One time, go in, big help. So mentoring means we have a gardening class in the village. The people have to take the gardening class. When they have finished the gardening class, then they have to prepare the ground themselves. They have to fence it with natural material themselves. And then they can earn a one-time reward of seeds, a hoe, and a watering can. Okay, so we get the garden planted. But now we have a gardening supervisor in the village, and we train a volunteer from that village to become the specialist there. Then he mentors this family along with the Care for Life field officer, and then they learn what they're doing wrong and what they're doing right and why their garden's not working. And, you know, it takes over time to really teach someone true behavior change.
And you use those same principles with the different areas that we focus on, with the sanitation, with home building construction, with financial management and
business,
how to work within the community. All those different things have different specialists who will work with the people in the community through learning these skills and applying them.
Wow. And, you know, I can hearken back when I was Ward Relief Society president. There was a family in our ward that had some great needs. And over the years, you know, they'd received a lot of help through the, you know, church, but nothing changed. And so it wasn't until we really went down deep. I won't go into all the details, what it took was getting the mom home, getting the dad a job, working with them for over a couple of years long term to make sure the mom knew how to do her job at home. The dad was able to overcome some issues he had and really provide for the family. And it was a weekly visit that we did. But they set goals, just like our people in Mozambique set goals. They set goals, and then we'd evaluate how they did with those goals every week. And, you know, it wasn't unlike kind of our kids and their tour charts, you know.
Yeah.
And they learned that way over time, but it took mentoring and it took understanding the basic problem.
We use a team approach. You know, there's all these different specialists. We call them field officers and supervisors that come in and create the same kind of knowledge within that community. And it's not unlike, you know, a ward welfare council, for example, who has a you know, particular need. I can think back as well when I was a bishop, and we had one sister who was underemployed, had two teenage kids, a young man, a young woman. And forever, I was just continuing to help, providing for the immediate needs. But we weren't getting anywhere, you know, with long-term changes until one day we came into our ward welfare committee, and I said, lock the door. You know, we don't have doors on locks, but I said, we're not leaving here. We're going to focus on one subject today, and it's going to be Sister So-and-so. And so we went around, and we just worked out what we would do to help in this situation. We talked about no one else that day but this one particular family. And so we arrived at you know, the conclusion that we would help her over 2 years go through a complete retraining to where she could, you know, get a job as a professional. I think it was in nursing. Someone talked about how they would take their son and get him employed, working with him and getting some job skills. And so we had a complete plan that was developed that we watched and nurtured over the next 2 years. And when we did it, it was successful. That's what we do in Mozambique, is we have a 2.5-year plan, not just with one individual or one family, but with an entire community. We actually work with about 4 communities at a time. So our staff is dealing with probably, you know, 800 to 1,000 people at a time and helping us through this process.
Well, 2,000 people in a village, so times that by 4. So it's more than that.
But and this concept of a plan is so important, because as you do in Mozambique, you are very clear that after 2.5 years, we're out of here. Like we're not going to be here.
We tell them that right up front, that we're not here.
The only reason we come back, we do come back, but it's only to measure, to get the data again about how much progress they've been making after we left. Yeah. So we come back after up to 5 years just to measure these different indicators and see if they're still progressing.
Yeah, and that could be such a powerful best practice, you know, for bishops to just say, okay, for 6 months or for a year, like, we're going to work with you, we're going to put a plan together, but know that when that time comes, we have to make progress because we can't continue. Yeah, this is for short-term needs, right?
And I think one of the successes of Care for Life is that we really took time to develop the family preservation program. That's what we call the program that we do, based on the needs of the people. And it wasn't our assessment of their needs.
Yeah.
It was their assessment of their needs.
Yeah.
And it took a few years to really come up with this program. And we identified 8 areas that they needed help in. Uh-huh. And just briefly, it's education, health and hygiene, food security and nutrition, sanitation, income generation, home improvement, psychosocial well-being, and community participation. And all those eight elements are important in order to achieve the success that we do. And I might just throw out that after we've done this now for, you know, almost 15 years with the Family Preservation Program, a recent study that the University of Utah did that was a controlled study to look at if really what we did was working, the results were that we were able to reduce maternal mortality rates in our villages by 78%.
Wow.
And infant mortality rate by 57%. And I really want to emphasize that it's all of those components working together. And I'll give you an example of how we did it wrong initially. So the government, when we first went in, the government, the Department of Health wanted us to train traditional birth attendants because they heard I was a midwife. They're like, come and train our traditional birth attendants. So we did a program, partnered with the church. We went in, we trained the traditional birth attendants. We gave them the equipment that they needed to have the three cleans for birth and the hands and all those things. And, you know, we thought, wow, this is really going to change. But you know what? Nothing really changed that much. The statistics didn't change. And we're like, wait, we trained the birth attendants. We gave them the equipment they needed. Why didn't it change? Then we were addressing the secondary problem. We went back to the village and we figured out, what are they doing wrong? Why is this? Why are we not seeing a change? And what we found out was it had to be a whole village thing. The traditional birth attendants would recognize the mother that needed to go to the hospital that was high risk, but the family wouldn't allow the woman to go to the hospital because they were afraid of the hospital. And so she might recommend it, but it didn't happen. And so it wasn't until we taught the whole village. We brought the whole village together. We taught them why a mom needs more food and more rest, and a certain mom needs to go to the hospital. And then the parents and the father and other people then would agree. And then they needed a bicycle ambulance and to get her there. And so there was a way that if the village met 80% of them met their goals, they could earn a bicycle ambulance. And so you really have to understand the problem. And then it has to be comprehensive enough that you're addressing those problems in order to get the results at the end. You know, the psychosocial part of it. Men would go off and drink and beat their wives, you know? And I really think that a lot of times microcredit, they focus on just the women because they kind of leave the dad out. But our feeling is, and with the gospel, we know that men are, you know, this is a family thing. We focus on the family. They were feeling inadequate that they couldn't provide for their family. And so pulling him in and making sure that he could provide for his family and start a business and do all those things, then teaching him to love and care for his family. You know, it's all a part of that. And he feels empowered now that he's got a way to provide food for his children and he doesn't feel bad. So he's not off drinking and beating his wife because he's frustrated.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd add is, you know, when you look at the, Cindy said earlier that we're in the orphan prevention business and that, you know, you create orphans when families fall apart, when mothers die. When you look at this statistic of 78% improvement of maternal mortality rates, by those mothers being saved through this whole process, then you see orphans not being created. And so it's not by going out and, like she said, delivering supplies to midwives. It's not done by developing a maternal, you know, hospital or birth center. It's done by looking at education, health and hygiene, food security, all these different areas that put a solid family together, a roof over their head, an income generation potential that'll improve the family's condition. When you have all that together, you're going to keep a family together and you're going to keep children there that are healthy as well and not create orphans.
Yeah. You know, there's two things I want to underscore that you've said throughout this. Is first, you remember that you mentioned this People First book that it taught you to go to the culture and understand them.
Yeah.
This is, it's easy to kind of fall in this trap, even in our context where I remember as a bishop, it's easy to have somebody, you know, I'm a middle-class bishop and then a lower-class person walks in and needs help and they need food and whatever. And so I try and project my middle-class perspective onto them. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to go over there and think, well, this is how we do it in the United States. Exactly. Let me give you the 5-point plan, you know, that you need to do. Where this, the solution, you identify the problem, but then the solution, this is what I'm learning and hearing, that the solution needs to come from the people.
It does.
And from them, that you can't just come there and project all of our first world perspectives on them.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And that, it takes some humility to do that, you know, because you think, hey, we've got it all figured out and we're going to go over and we're going to teach you. And really what we found out was when we went over, they taught us.
Yeah.
I mean, they taught us, how do you survive with nothing? And, you know, I mean, it's amazing the things that they are able to do, and they want to be the ones to fix the problem, you know. And even initially, when we went in to villages, like, here's just a little example, a very bad example. So people here were going to Africa. Oh, I made all these toys and I want you to send them over and give them to the people. And some well-meaning celebrities, which I won't name names, you know, would spend billions of dollars, and they were giving away dolls to the girls and, you know, soccer balls to the boys. And I'm like, uh-uh. You know, the girls don't want dolls. They carry their babies on their back from the time they're, you know, 4 years old. They got a baby on their back. So it's not understanding, you know, the issue. And we did that one time. We went into a village. We started passing out those dolls. I mean, it turned into a riot. And we realized, whoa, this was so the wrong approach. Uh-huh. So from then on, we would always just meet with the village chief. We would tell him what we were doing. He was then the one that presented the plan to the villagers. And, you know, with a family, we do, I feel like you need to do that with the parents and the father. Let him take the lead. Let the mom take the lead in how this is done. And really understand the issues. You know, if they're economically really challenged, there's probably some underlying issues there that you really have to look at and figure out, you know, how, where the relationship is, and address all of those things.
Yeah. And so I want to better understand maybe how that's done, where you went there and you, like, how did you start to put these pieces together? And I'm just thinking that in a Relief Society president's perspective, they have that problem family who's perpetually just waiting for the next welfare check. You know, I'm learning that maybe you go to their home, you understand better their experiences, what their day-to-day life, some of the hurdles in their life. But then how do you start piecing together, like, okay, here's three things you need without projecting your perspective onto it? Does that make sense?
Well, I think they were the ones that came up with the family preservation program. Basically, we said, you know, what is it you need? And then they would say, well, you know, that, like the man said, we need knowledge. Okay, what knowledge did you lose? You know, they'd had civil war, they'd had colonization. They basically just lost the basic knowledge of what makes you sick. And we didn't even understand that, gotcha. You know? And so talking to them, and they didn't come right out and say, like, oh, we don't know how to set a goal. But you observe that after you see that they just live from day to day. We're like, you know what? When you talk about a goal to build a house or build bricks, that's just not even in their vocabulary. And so it takes really working with them, sitting down, trying to be prayerful and understand what the real needs are. And then, you know, we initially started small with just teaching health classes and teaching the gardening classes. But then later they came to us and said, we want to do some kind of microcredit thing. You know, we want to be able to build our business. I know that I can have a small business doing fixing bicycle tires, but I want to build that business. And so the Grameen Bank and all that whole thing with microcredit, it's a great idea, but you got to have a funder behind it. Mm-hmm. And so we learned from the people themselves that, you know, we could each pool, you know, a few Medicais together, and then we could loan all that to one person at one time. They came up with those ideas themselves. Mm. And so I feel like we do too much talking, not enough listening. Mm. You know, really listen to find out what the needs are. And, you know, they also came to us and said, you know, our houses are falling apart. And that wasn't something that we really understood or thought of. And well, then we would have the idea, well, let's go buy a bunch of material. Oh, no, we have native material. We can do it with this. We just need certain things to make the bricks stick together or something. And so their solution, I think you just have to talk to people and really try to get a better understanding of where to start.
One thing that might apply as well, though, is a basic lesson we learned. People have often asked us, okay, so what have you learned, you know, in your experience in Africa? And you might ask, what do we learn that can apply to people here? And I think that's what your question was. And I don't want to give the impression that we, you know, by the instruction, the teaching we're doing, that they didn't have capacity.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things we've learned is that it's not a matter of intelligence or capacity. They have as much capacity and intelligence as anybody else. It's oftentimes just a lack of experience that they have not had, or the lack of opportunity that they haven't had. One time, I'll just give an example of when this came to my attention, that I was there with these personal biases. I had biases that, you know, were there to give something as opposed to learn from them. And It was, we'd been there for a couple of years and we were just starting this Care for Life Education Center. And so we were there. We had a team of BYU students and others who were there with us. And we had a young man who was a math major. He was a graduate student. And I noticed he'd been tutoring a young man from a different orphanage, an older kid's orphanage. And this young man was probably 15, 16, 17. And they were doing some college algebra. And so my natural inclination was to ask him the question, ask this BYU student, is he getting any of this? And the answer, this is one of those, you know, aha moments that just taught me. He says, getting this, he says, I'm not teaching him anything. Hmm. He understands this book and the principles of this college algebra backward and forward. I'm giving him a little bit of guidance. But at that moment, I had to stop back and just say, you know, just check your biases and see what you believe. And so that's the thing we've learned going forward, I think, as much as anything, is that they just need a little guidance and the opportunities to succeed. It's not a matter of not having the capacity to succeed. They do. And if you're sitting across the bishop's desk from someone that you might not think has the capacity, you know, check your biases and give them that responsibility and that opportunity to grow and develop. Yeah. And they will if you trust that they can. We're all children of God. We all have that capacity. And you just need to create the right environment for them to, you know, to make some progress in life. And they will.
Yeah. I love that because we can almost, you know, we write that welfare check month after month thinking that, well, they, you know, maybe there's a bias there. They don't have a capacity to go out and figure this out. So I have to keep giving because if I stop giving, they'll shrivel up and die, you know.
And I think there's something about empowering people to make the change themselves, you know, rather than feeling all grateful to you because you came and you did all these things for us. You know, I remember when you go into the villages before we start the program, I mean, it is hopeless. That's what it feels like. It's just desperate. And families can get to that point too. And this one young man, I mean, he just sat there all day and just didn't do anything. You know, he was just like, he was 18. He couldn't get a job because there's no jobs available. And, you know, he just was down and depressed and did nothing. And so when we came in, we taught him about goals. We taught him how to set goals. And we really empowered them to say, you can change your life. You don't need someone to come in here and give you a scholarship of $5,000 to go to, you know, some school. You can do this by yourself. Mm. And he's like, you know, you could see this like wheels start to turn, like I can with the knowledge, these basic things that we can help you. And so he took a hold of this idea of, you know, I can set a goal and I can reach this goal. And he became like one of the volunteers in that village that became the specialist, you know, in like the gardening specialist. And everybody came to him for advice. He learned, he went to this gardening class, he asked questions. He really got empowered and suddenly he wasn't a nobody anymore. He was like the guy everybody came to for the answers because he really dug in and he learned and he had this beautiful garden and it just changed his life completely from being like hopeless to this one little skill that I learned can change me, you know? And there was another young man who he was an orphan and he was taking care of his two brothers and sisters who were orphans and his parents died when he was 14 and he had these two little siblings. And when we taught him about goals, that you can have a goal, and he's like, you mean I could have a house? Because they'd been basically just homeless and just begging. And we taught him how to make bricks and he just went to work and the excitement in that family, he and his siblings made like thousands of bricks and they built a house. And he also learned to do a business and kids are all in school and it didn't cost us a bunch of money. It was a matter of letting him know that you can do this, you know, and letting them take the responsibility for changing themselves and then giving them the credit when they did it.
Wow.
And
wow.
So a lot of times we think the answer is just more money. And, you know, it really is helping people change this idea that they can change their life and they have the ability to do that. And we'll be there to mentor them and to help them, but we're not going to be there for a long time and they got to take advantage of this opportunity. And maybe it is, instead of just giving them food every month, it's looking at the vocational program. That's why I love this new self-reliance program is, you know, maybe they do need to get their resume and go out there and find a better job and, you know, all those things. And so opening those horizons for them.
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, the old adage, famous adage of, you know, you feed a man a fish, you feed him for a day.
Yeah.
If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. But it even goes a step before that. If you teach a man how to teach a man how to fish, like that, suddenly you save the village, right?
Yes.
And this is,
and
talk
that's
about that.
Exactly what we do. We tell them, okay, so we go into a village, we're there for 2.5 years, we pull out, we leave. But that's not the end of that village. We monitor that village for 5 years with these 53 indicators. And we go back, and these people have learned to work together. Anybody that moves into their village, they got a standard they got to keep now. They can't just throw their garbage anywhere. They have to dig a latrine. They have to, you know, they have to keep their place clean. So these people teach the other people. And that's an also empowering. We tell them, now you are the teacher. And so take this family that you've just helped and give them the job to help another family, you know, and then the villages around the outside, we call it the positive deviant. They look at this and they're like, whoa, that guy looks way better and their family looks better and I wonder what they're doing. And so then they can become the teachers of other people. And that's empowering to them as well. It's like, yeah, look what I did with my life and now I'm going to help you.
We've seen some communities that have gone beyond what we've worked with them to improve like their infrastructure. One village worked with the local municipalities to bring in electrical power into their village to make improvements in the roads and the water situation. So they've taken upon themselves now, after they've learned these basic skills, to go ahead and take a step further.
Yeah.
That's because they learned they can do it,
that
there are solutions. And sometimes you just sit there thinking, oh, if I only had $10,000, then I could, you know, go to this school and that would change my life. But, you know, our program doesn't cost very much money. It's just a matter of giving them some rewards. And people do need rewards. Like the poorest of the poor, they have to have a little bit of help, but it's like a one-time thing. And we tell them, okay, one time you're going to get seeds, a hoe, and a watering can. From then on, you got to learn to harvest your own seeds and you got to, you know, do it for the rest of the time yourself. But they do learn that.
And I just think of the individual development, you know, bringing, you know, working with a municipality to get power there. There's probably a rich celebrity that could have written a check and gotten power there. But now that it has power, think of the development of those individuals that live in the town that can then perpetuate that state of mind.
This model, and they'll come to say we have done it ourselves. They have done it themselves.
And I really feel like a very key is, okay, we give them the initial knowledge and the opportunity, whatever that is. But that mentoring part is really important, whether that's the new ministering people that we have, you know, somebody's got to mentor you. They've got to go to your house and look at your garden and find out why it's not growing. And then they say, okay, what have you tried this? Okay, well, what about this? And then sit there and listen and help them. And wherever you can, they form groups to help each other. Then it isn't just us coming to do the mentoring. It's the other people in the village going, well, my garden, when I had that problem, we did this. And so you get people helping each other and working together. And I think that's where we often don't do it right. We do the big parachute project in the beginning and say, okay, well, now go, good luck, you know. And but that mentoring thing is important.
Yeah. It's really critical. I look at the church's materials on the self-reliance program are marvelous. These resource manuals are amazing. But if they just give one of those manuals to someone and say, here's your resource.
Or they take the class one time.
Take the class one time. They're not going to see success. They've got to have this teamwork approach where people are working together. So when in our communities in Care for Life, when they come in, there's local mentors who work with them. And they'll come in initially in these eight areas. They might have one goal in each of those or maybe five or six goals they're working on for the first 6 months. And a mentor is coming in working with them every couple of weeks to check and see, you know, their progress and their status and working with them to achieve that. Once they achieve that, they go to another set of five or six or seven goals and they work on those. So over 2.5 years, they may have four time periods where they've worked on 20, 30 of these 50 different indicators that they've selected to work in their life. But they've always had a group, a district, and a zone and leaders to work with them to mentor them through that process. So it's a lot of help.
Wow. And these mentors are the local natives.
They are.
Right. Yeah. Right. Wow. Right. They identify, volunteers from their village.
From the U.S. to do this. It's local people doing that.
Yeah. That's such a powerful model. Anything else about this, mentoring leaders that we haven't hit on did we cover that okay?
Well, I will say that you have to celebrate success. We have celebration days too along there. And so people know that we're going to have a celebration and you set your goal. And then when you reach your goal, you're going to get recognized. Something, you got to get a little reward. It's the star on your forehead, you know, with a little kid to check on their chart. People, you they need that positive feedback. So we have a celebration day and okay, these people have met their goals and they don't get anything for it other than we just have a party and they dance and they celebrate and they get recognized. And in the end, when we graduate, we have graduation, when we leave, families get a certificate that, you know, they've become a self-reliant family. And those little recognitions are important. You know, way to go. You did that. You met that goal. And even if you didn't meet that goal, you got part of that goal done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, you got to give some positive, the positive feedback is important.
Let me answer your question, Curtin. This is a little bit different way too about leaders. You know, when we went there, I mentioned how we got there when, you know, after this hurricane and the conditions were just dire. They were just bad. And over the years of helping not only the village leaders, but people within Care for Life, we have developed a lot of young people who have become the leaders for the church there in Mozambique.
Wow.
And, you know, we were counseled earlier to make sure we didn't, you know, blur the lines between church and what we're doing. And we have. But on the other hand, we've created the capacity for people to be able to be not only self-reliant, but able to have the time, the resources, the skills to help others. And so a number of our people have been, you know, branch presidents, bishops, district leaders, stake presidents, people who have been able to have capacity to serve because they've developed these skills for themselves. And so as you're doing this, you're creating the future leaders in a culture.
Wow. That's a legacy that it's worth waking up for, you know, that's great.
It goes back to the Maslow hierarchy of needs. You know, you can't really be active in the church. And if this family is not active until you get certain things in place over in Mozambique, it's, you got to be well enough to get to church. You got to have food to eat. So you have the strength to walk, you know, you got to have enough money to take the bus to get there. And so you got to work on those things before. So sometimes we jump in and, oh, come back to church, get active, where there's other needs that have to be met first. And once they can get those needs met, then they can think about, oh, now maybe I can read the Book of Mormon, or, you know, maybe
you help them to get to work on Monday morning. So someday they can get to church on Sunday morning.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. So one of our earlier supporters used to have this kind of unofficial goal for Care for Life. He said, you know, we want to be temporal centers of strength.
Preceding
spiritual centers of strength.
Oh, I like that.
And you can have, you know, this nonprofit, non-church organization that we've had, you know, provide that kind of temporal strength so that then people could then develop their spirituality. And that's what we've seen happen.
Yeah.
You know, we've had lots of interesting experiences about this, but it really has been fun just to see the hand of the Lord in taking something that was completely undirected, you know, by the church. People would ask us, well, who told you could go over and do that? And well, nobody told us. The Lord did.
I get that question all the time. Who said you could start this podcast? I did, I guess.
The Lord did. And, you know, you feel inspired to do things. But you see in the end that, you know, how that it all fits together and how one hand blesses the other.
Yeah. Wow. That's
and
awesome.
The Lord really, really does open the doors. You know, if I know that He knows the needs of the people. He knows the needs of the families that you're working with when you're the Relief Society president or the bishop. He knows the needs of the extreme poor in the remote corners of the world. And everybody has different doors that open for them. You know, if you're just willing to walk through the door when something happens, and this was the door we walked through, but everybody out there has doors that open for them because the Lord's putting those pieces together. And, you know, I was scared to death the first time I decided to go to Mozambique. Every time I told somebody that I was going to Mozambique, I like got tears in my eyes. It was like, I have no idea what I'm doing there. And when I got there, I went with just young people. I took my two younger daughters and a translator and two college students. We went there, we landed. I had no clue what I was going to do next. And that's okay because the Lord knows what to do. So, I mean, I'm just laying there thinking, why did I come? Why did I feel that I should be here? So that first night, we're walking down to a restaurant and we see this truck that says Pro Familia on the side. And I'm like, let's talk to this lady. We tell this lady, we just came from America. We just have this feeling there's something we can do to help. She goes, oh, my cousin is the minister of health. And the church had told us before when I talked to them about going there, like, yeah, you should go get to the highest level of government you can get in and say, here's how I can help. I'm like, right, you know, we're just going to walk in. Well, that's what happened. We met this lady. She's like, come to my house tonight. My cousin's coming over. He's the minister of health. The next morning, we are sitting in the minister of health's office with his whole team. And they're like, wow. Here's this midwife, and she's here, and she's going to, you know, offer to help us. And it really was amazing to watch how the Lord did that. And then, you know, suddenly we're off on with a letter for the minister of health to go look at the villages and see what's going on. And it's been like that from the beginning. So I guess if somebody has this impression, like, well, gosh, this door kind of opened, should I go through it? Should I, but I don't know how to do it. Just do it. And the Lord will open the way.
Yeah.
And it might sound really
scary
and impossible or whatever, but, and we're still kind of like that. I mean, every year we're like, are we going to make enough money to meet the budget that we need to open the five villages that we're planning on opening next year?
Yeah.
But we've learned that the Lord does take care of his people.
We're not particularly risk averse. You know, I think as a couple, we're willing to go to Africa, you know, and do things that are kind of different. And it comes back to that open door situation. You know, when the doors has opened, we've been willing to walk through it. I like to think back about Elder Packer's statement when he talked about, you know, listening to the Spirit. And he talked about, you know, you have to sometimes walk to the edge of the dark and then take a couple more steps and you see that you can still see. You still see the light. The light kind of follows you. And that's what we've seen. We haven't seen the end from the beginning of some of these efforts we've had in Africa or in other things in our life. We've been willing to, you know, step through that door and see what happens and be prayerful and try to, you know, work within certain principles that we understand, but we haven't been afraid to take that step. And I think you'll find that same situation. Again, I'll bring it back to the church. You'll see people that you work with who might be afraid to act because of their past experiences, some couple or individual you're working with. And you have to help them provide an environment that is supportive enough that they can take that initiative to say, yes, Bishop, I will do that.
Yeah.
I'll accept that call. I will take your counsel in this situation. Even though I'm not quite sure how it's going to end up, I will accept that call. So you teach them how to do that.
Yeah.
But the Lord has a plan. He has a plan. Right. And it doesn't mean you won't make mistakes and things won't go wrong. And you learn from those and you don't let it stop you. There's been a few times we've hit some pretty big walls and we're like, I don't know if this is going to work or not. But somehow it works out, you know?
Yeah.
And you learn from those experiences. And I think the Family Preservation Program kind of came to be because we learned what didn't work. And that was part of the process.
Yeah. And we've hit on it before, but I want to make sure before we wrap up to hit on this concept of exit strategies, because I know somewhere, usually people tell me they listen to this podcast on the treadmill. So there's a bishop somewhere running his heart out thinking, you know, and it's typically they inherit some of these families where they get called as bishop and there's this family that's been receiving church welfare for 4, 5 years, 6 years, and they got to be the bad guy to tell them this is over. So they just keep paying it because that's just how it goes. Yeah, so what can we learn? And you've said some things about exit strategies, but what could you teach us about creating an effective exit strategy or even introducing that concept?
Do it right at the first of all.
Okay.
I mean, it has to be one of the first things on the table that, and working with, in our communities, they know when we come in, even before they accept our invitation to come in, that we're only going to be there for 2.5 years. This is a defined program.
And they're going to have to work really hard.
You hit it really hard
in the beginning. Okay, let's hit it. We got 8 areas of focus and you're going to set goals in all those areas. So maybe you identify, okay, where's this family, where the needs are? And you really have to get to all of those needs. And maybe it isn't just a new vocation. Maybe it's you've got to go down to the very personal relationship that they have with each other and how they're solving their problems. Maybe it takes counseling. Maybe you buddy them up with another couple of families. You know, you really have to come up with a plan. And so I think that the family preservation plan that we've come up with, we know works getting people from extreme poverty to self-reliance. But you've got to come up with a personalized plan for that family. And you do maybe have to hit it harder. And it takes more work in the beginning. Okay, what's it going to look like 2 years from now? How's it going to be different? And how are we going to get you to where you don't need this anymore? And then break that down into smaller goals, you know, okay, for the next 6 months, here's what you're going to do. You know, we're even doing that with our organization right now. We're saying, okay, we've been funding you guys. Now you've got to come up with 10% of your budget next year. How are you going to do that? So the way that we do that is we go over and teach them how to write grants. We do the paperwork for them to become a Mozambican organization so they can apply for grants. So we ask them that question and they come up with the answers. Okay, how are we going to get you off of this in 2 years? And then provide the support that they need, whatever that might be, so that they know in 2 years they're not going to have a food order anymore.
But dig deeper. You know, the old needs assessment form that we used to do years ago. I mean, all it was you had the Relief Society president go in and see what they had in their cupboard in their kitchen. And, and that was like, that was their needs. Just, you know, fill those needs. And
need more chicken soup. We turn that.
You know, what we're talking about is, you know, what are the psychosocial needs of this family?
Wow.
What are the educational needs of this family or this individual?
The spiritual
needs of this family. So all those things you're looking at, and you got to dig deeper till you find out what the real needs are.
And maybe they're doing something they hate, and so they don't want to go to work. Maybe you've got a completely, you know, we had a lady in our ward, and she had great needs, and she was a single mom. And finally, she said, I've always wanted to be a nurse. So we basically took a year. She went to a nursing program, and we really helped a lot with childcare and everything through that year. It was a lot of needs that she had in order to leave her family and go. But in a couple years, she had a job, and she didn't need help anymore. And wow. So I think it's sitting down and really assessing, you know, where everything they're at, making sure you're addressing the primary problem, not the secondary problem, and helping them decide, you know, I'm going to work really hard and I want to be self-reliant. And I back up on this even when we first went into villages, people didn't really want to do the work. They just wanted the food. Just bring us the food.
That's what the last guy did, right?
And some villages, some villages we didn't work in because the leaders weren't amenable to the idea that this is your work and you're going to learn it and you're going to do it and we're not going to give you stuff. And so we went to other places because those leaders were like, you know.
Wow. And so getting that commitment up front are you willing to work for
this? Do you really want to be self-reliant?
Yeah.
You know, do you really want that? And why would you want that as opposed to this? And helping them see that this isn't just there. It's a generational change that happens with our families. We're never going back to those villages. They're going to teach their children and they're going to teach their children and they're going to become self-reliant.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to see that really big picture that they can do it and believe they can.
Yeah. It makes me think of many interviews I had as a bishop of somebody who'd come in and they, you can almost see it in their eyes of why do you keep talking, ask me questions, just get the form out.
Yeah.
And give me the food order, you know? And so that's maybe a good indication of like, I'm just here for that secondary need. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a good indication of not a good fit there. But then you also mentioned as far as the exit plan, bring it up front, hitting it hard. I like that concept.
Uh-huh.
And then just implementing these other principles you've touched on as quickly as possible. And then when that time frame comes, whether it's 6 months or 2 years or whatever is, you can remember or have that conversation a little bit easier because they were aware of the exit strategy up front.
And explain the plan that initially we will give you a lot of help, but then you're going to help each other. Yeah. And this other family that's kind of gone through this is now going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to back out. And it's not going to be the bishop and the elders, quorum president that we meet with you every week.
Then it's
going
to be the ministering brothers or
sisters. And then I think it's important that the ministering brothers and sisters also understand their role, not just here's the name, go visit this person, but, you know, sit down with these new people who are supposed to be helping this family and explain, here's where we've come with them. Now, here's where the goals are still out there and we need you to help them reach this next level of goals. I think sometimes we don't explain the needs of a family enough that you can be an effective minister. It takes you 6 months to figure out what even the problem is, you know? So share the information that you can with a long-term goal that this family is going to be here instead of where they are, and what break that down into how we're going to do that. And
that's
it
great.
Isn't just the job of the bishop and the Relief Society president, and then other families helping each other, meeting together, empowering each other. And when you can see a family that's done it, then it's fun for that family to be the ones to reach out.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, man, we're probably not going to cover it all in a simple hour interview, but any other point or principle that you want to make sure we mention before we wrap up?
I think of your audience and you know, leaders in the church and how they apply this stuff to them. And you know, there are correct principles that probably can be followed in any issue, any situation. I remember, you know, as a bishop many years ago, Cindy would criticize me early in my bishop experience, you know, for all the time I spend with, you know, marriage counsel, with people who are struggling together. And
I would criticize.
So then I think, after that, I
don't know that anybody listened, and it was the same thing over and over.
Then I'd send everybody to you know, professional counselors. And, you know, so the next 2 years, they'd all get referred out to LDS social services, you know. Then I'd find out the same people were still having the same problems. And I come back to realize that it just was not following some basic gospel principles. And so I think late in my bishop experience, I'd sit down with couples and say, listen, I said, I can help you focus on correct principles and the application of those principles. And if you're willing to do that, you can solve these problems. If you're not willing to do that, to save us all, you know, a lot of time, I'm not going to send you off to counseling. I'm not going to spend my hours here at night. It's a matter of following these correct principles. And if you follow and do these things, you'll have success. And that's where you finally get some results when people follow correct principles. And we have some correct principles in, you know, in humanitarian services that that we like to see, and we know that they work. I think that what the church is doing with the self-reliance program is wonderful.
Yeah. We've seen that. Yeah, embrace that for sure.
We sat through some discussions of the old welfare program in Mozambique and trying to apply that there, and it just wasn't working at all.
Yeah.
When they came up with this will work. It's based upon correct principles.
Yeah, that's awesome. If people hear this and they want to be more involved in Care for Life, where would you send them?
The website,
careforlife.org, www.careforlife.org. And we have great videos on there. We explain this family preservation program. There's ways to volunteer. And we're just a very small organization, really. We're run by all volunteers. We have 35 employees we pay in Mozambique, but the rest of us are just volunteers. So we invite anyone to come and look at what we're doing, and we'd be happy to, you can connect with us through the website.
Yeah. And obviously you take, you know, donations, monetary donations.
That's how we survive.
Are there other ways that you're also looking for people to help?
Yes. Uh-huh. And there's ways if you want to volunteer. There's a thing on the website that talks about we take teams over doing different things, or people can volunteer here on this side in the U.S. to help us as well.
Well, yeah, one more question I want you both to answer separately. And Blair, we'll start with you, and that gives time, Cindy gets the advantage to have time to think. But in your work with, you know, Care for Life, and as you've been a leader to a lot of these people, you know, they've seen you as a leader. How has this work made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, every year we at Christmas we kind of give our little gift to Jesus as one of our Christmas Eve things. And my gift this year was just greater humility, and that was the one thing that I wrote on my little list. My one word was humility, and I think we all have to continue to, you know, to learn from the experiences we've had in life and to realize that all those experiences, those gifts that we have are given to us by the Savior and our Heavenly Father. And if we have that humility, He can teach us, He can use us. We can go through those open doors that wherever we're called to serve or however we're called to help someone else as a mentor. But it really comes down to trusting God that He has a plan for us and following when you get those promptings. I love this C.S. Lewis quote. Years ago, I heard this, the more often we feel without acting, the less we'll be able to act. And in the end, the less we'll be able to feel. So those promptings that come, we've got to respond to them. We've got to be humble enough to know that the Lord's talking to us and will use us if we just simply listen to those promptings and act on them.
Love it. Cindy, what about you? How has this work made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, years ago when I started this, somebody shared with me an experience that Mother Teresa had. An interviewer came to Mother Teresa and they said, you know, we want to talk to you about what you do in India and how you help the people that are dying. And she said, you go first, serve a week in the house of the dying, and then I'll do the interview with you after that. And he came back later and he said, oh, after seeing all that, you know, I just can't imagine how awful their lives are. I never knew how much suffering there was in the world. And, you know, why did those people have so hard of a life? And I had, you know, such an easy life. And Mother Teresa looked at him and she said, well, maybe you weren't worthy. And I love that. You know, I feel like sometimes when we have so much, it actually hinders us from learning the things that are really most important, you know? And I think that the struggles that we go through can teach us to become Christ-like in ways that if we don't have struggles, we might not learn those things that we need to learn. And I remember as a leader just feeling so overwhelmed with all the problems that would come, you know, to me, and hearing all the problems that people had. And a wise woman once said to me, "Cindy, a lot of these problems were here before you were called, and they're still going to be here when you leave. You know, do what you can." And I think there's a balance in all of that. You can give, like Blair did when he was a bishop, 100% of your time to your people that you're trying to help. And you have to find that balance. You know, I can't do everything in Africa. I can't give 100% of my time. I can't go to every village, but I can do something. And I know that the Lord knows my capacities. He knows what I'm able to do and what I can't do. And I trust that He can make up the difference in those things. I remember one night, my very first trip to Africa, and I was totally overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed with all the problems I saw around me and I just was sad. And I remember that night, I saw this woman in the day who had her arms cut off. And this was something that had happened from the war. They would come in and people would do that to intimidate the villagers to do what they said. And this woman was begging and she held up her stump to our car to get some bread. And it just, I will never forget that. And that night, I remember going to the scriptures and opening them and reading about poverty and reading the different scriptures about poverty. And I remember reading about that there was a scripture in Isaiah that talked about, you know, the Lord will exchange beauty for ashes and the oil of joy for mourning. And that all the hard things that happen in life, the atonement answers that. Somehow it really does and can answer that. And maybe I can only help them a little bit now, but ultimately through the atonement, those people that have suffered so much, they're going to have joy again. That through the atonement of Christ, all of these things, the tears will be wiped away from all of the faces and they will have joy. And mortality is hard. You can do so much. You can't do it everything you want to do, and you have to balance the needs of your family and your kids and your life, and you can do something and know that the Lord will help you, but ultimately the atonement will cover it all, and in the end it'll all be okay. In the end, we just do what we can do and trust that the Lord will give us direction and strength, and then the rest we'll just wait.
That concludes my interview with Blair and Cindy Packard. I appreciate them allowing me to come to their home and just learn from them. What remarkable people they are, and the ways that they're making a difference in their own special way is inspiring for sure. I encourage you to go to careforlife.org, make a contribution, or see how you can volunteer, or just be more familiar with what they're doing. And I think your life will be absolutely blessed by becoming more familiar with that organization and following the patterns that they carry forward in their organization. And don't forget, visit our product store at leadingsaints.org and check out the 2019 Ward calendar. And remember, be a leader, not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.